Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lambcast. This is episode 726, and I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, from Kirkham A Movie A Day. This week, there's something strange in the neighborhood. Again. We have the fifth film in the Ghostbusters franchise, Frozen Empire. With the discovery of an ancient artifact unleashes an evil force, Ghostbusters new and old must join forces to protect their home and save the world from a second ice age. We have our own team of Ghostbusters this week, ready to do some busting, because it makes us feel good. First up, Lisa Leahy from Rabbit Hole Podcasts.
There is no Lisa. Nope. There is no Lisa. There is only Zool.
Next, the Forgotten Film Cast, Todd Liebenau. Some of the smartest people I know are morons. Can you say the same?
Well, I choose to think of this as the fourth installment in the franchise, so, you know.
I knew I liked you, Todd.
We're skipping a number, I know. And finally, Matt Hudson from What I Watched Tonight. Is it super secret underground ghostbusting stuff, or do we get to talk about it today?
Back off, man. I'm a scientist. Very, very excited to talk about some Ghostbusters today. Maybe not all five of them, but certainly this one.
We'll probably touch on the other ones as well. That'll happen. I'm going to remind people that we're going to be spoiler-free for a while. And, you know, we're going to start with some general observations at first. We'll probably drop the spoiler wall within 20 or 30 minutes. Not that I think that there are big problems here. Most people have a pretty good idea what's going to happen. So it's not like there's huge surprises here. But there are a couple of little dollops of fun here and there that maybe we should keep to ourselves until we get to an appropriate point. We're going to start with our general thoughts, and I thought I would ask Lisa first, since she signed up for this first and demanded that I make sure that she get in before anybody else. So,
now, wait a minute. I was more polite than that.
Yes, you were slightly more polite than that.
I believe my email was two words. Ghostbusters, please.
Yes. Please, now.
it might have been. My favorite movie is Ghostbusters. So, I mean, yes, I'm going to be here for this. And, yes, I have many opinions. I got to tell you, I wasn't thrilled. I didn't hate it. It's not Afterlife. My thing is I don't want these movies. I want to keep them the way they are. I want to stick with the first two and leave it at that. I'm assuming that Todd is speaking of the 2016 Ghostbusters that we pretend didn't exist, because many, many, many problems with that. And no, I am not a rabid fanboy who's mad that they're girls. Who cares? I'm mad that it's a bad movie. I feel like we're starting to head toward that direction again with this one, because I did not feel the writing was any good. I thought there were two glaring problems with decisions that characters made, because those characters would not have made that decision. And, you know, as much as I enjoyed the first half and the fan service that I got out of it, the rest of it really just kind of fell flat for me. And I can get into details later on, because I don't want to steal thunder from other people.
Yeah, we'll give other people a chance to weigh in a little bit before we get into some of those details. But I'm definitely going to want to know about those two decisions that you're concerned with, and you know, what you think falls apart in the second half of the film. Matt, how about you? How did you feel about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire?
Well, for the majority of my life, Boston has made me feel good. And I didn't mind the 2016 Ghostbusters, but I understand all of the concerns. So I went into this one, I really enjoyed Afterlife. You know, I really got so much out of that film. And the trailers for this one came out, and I thought, okay, they're not really selling me too much, but let's wait till we see it. And I'm pretty similar to Lisa, really, in the sense that I didn't dislike this film, but I certainly didn't love it. And I'm also in the stable of kind of thinking, man, I wish they could rediscover that magic of that first one and of that second one, because I watched it a week or so ago and it has flaws and it is a retread of the first, but it still has that, you know, the parody of the supernatural horror genre, and it's still got that sort of snarky satire about it as well, which I feel like we're missing in these last two. Afterlife was a different beast, of course, because of the emotional heaviness attached to the late great Harold Ramis. And this is the first time it's had to stand on its own since then. And I've got to say, there were some issues in there, which I'd heard were make or break. And yeah, I love the risk taking, but you got to nail it. And I don't think they nailed all the risks they went for. So liked it, certainly didn't love it.
Okay. Todd, I know that Ghostbusters was your favorite film of your favorite film year, so you're going to have opinions about all of these movies. Right now, though, we're going to start with Frozen Empire.
Well, I think my view is similar to the others so far. I think on the whole, I would say that I enjoyed the film, but yeah, as I was kind of mulling it over and trying to think, okay, what do I think of this? I kind of went back to what I was feeling when I walked out of the theater in 1989 after Ghostbusters 2, where I was like, you know, I enjoyed that. I had fun with that, but it certainly pales in comparison to the previous entry. Now, granted, I think 99.99999% of the movies ever made pale in comparison to the original Ghostbusters. To me, the 1984 film is a perfect film. I have absolutely no flaws with it.
Did I mention that I really like you, Todd? You're a good guy.
It's a brilliant
mix. I mean, there aren't even Muppets in this movie, and you love it as much.
And, you know, after I saw Ghostbusters 2, I'm 5 years older at that point. I just graduated from high school, and I'm going to the movies every week because I got a car and I got money and that. And, you know, Ghostbusters 2, I was kind of like, okay, there's fun stuff there, but it just didn't quite get there. And it's kind of the same way here, I think, with Frozen Empire, because Afterlife was great. I mean, it brought me everything I wanted and tugged the heartstrings and all that kind of stuff. And I think Frozen Empire makes a valiant effort. It's got, a tough act to follow, and it's got some issues where they're trying to do an awful lot. I mean, it's going to be a tough job where you're trying to, give time to the new characters. You're trying to give time to the legacy characters. It also really, really looks like Sony's trying to create a cinematic universe here, with kind of the, Winston's people, crew here. And, I think that in some ways they're trying to do too much. But I think there are still some things that the film does quite well. So overall, I enjoyed it, but it does pale compared to Afterlife.
All right. Well, I'm going to agree with everybody for the most part. I don't think that this is a great film. I do think it's an entertaining film. And we have to put it a little bit into context. We're never going to get the magic that was the first Ghostbusters in any other form. And as much as they might try, the chemistry is just never going to perfectly balance like that. So we're going to have to make do with other things. And there are a lot of other things in this particular movie that I think work pretty well. I'm going to admit something. I was a lot more indifferent to it the first time I saw it. I did go back and see it again because I am a consumer. My daughters stole the best idea for a website that I can think of, Hollywood Consumer. That's me. We went back to see it because Alamo had a special menu item that we were looking forward to and said, well, you only get that if you go see Ghostbusters. We've already seen it, but that's okay. We'll go back and get it anyway. It was a milkshake. And, of course, guess what? They ran out of the ingredients for the milkshake.
No!
Yes. It was very frustrating. So we were not in a great mood when we sat down to see it for the second time, not getting the milkshake that we were looking forward to. But as I'm watching the movie, I think because I was aware of kind of how it was going to play out and how different it was going to be from all the other things that had come before it, I appreciated it a little bit more, and I think I came to the conclusion that I liked it a lot better than I thought I did. And so in the long run, I do think that it's probably going to grow on people. I don't think, of course, it has the same kind of emotional resonance that Afterlife ended up having. And, of course, it's just never going to have the freshness that we had with the first Ghostbusters. But there are things in this that I think are worth pursuing. There are some things that I think are a little bit iffy, but we're going to get into that as we go along. So You know, my take on it is it's a solid entertainment, but not a great movie. And it's certainly never going. You know, when we get into the pantheon of all the Ghostbusters films, we'll see where it ranks. I can certainly say it's going to rank above that 2016 film that doesn't exist.
Well, one of the things that struck me with this, and I'm interested in everybody else's take, but you know, comparing the 84 and 89 films, and now Afterlife and Frozen Empire, it strikes me that we've moved away from comedy being the priority. I think this is a supernatural adventure first and a comedy second. The comedy beats, there's some good ones, but there were several that kind of fell flat, which kind of caught me off guard. You know, there were a few moments where I was just thinking, like, can I even call this a comedy? I think actually the savior from the comedic standpoint on this film is Kumail Nanjiani. You know, as his character started to develop more, we had some good solid comedic moments. But I don't know what the rest of you think, but I thought that, you know, it was kind of making laughs the second priority here.
I can't think of anything that Dan Aykroyd said that was funny. And how do you do that when his character was so hysterical in the first movie?
Well, for one, he didn't write it.
Yeah, that'll make
true,
a difference.
That, and you don't have Harold Ramis writing it. You also have a kids' movie. You're talking about spiritual adventure and no, it's a kids' movie. You have a director who directs kids' movies. You have a writer who made kids' movies, with the exception of the hideous Poltergeist remake, which we're going to also pretend doesn't exist. It's a kids' movie. We have shifted away from a movie that was PG at the time, would have been PG-13 had it come out literally a month later.
Right.
And that movie was for adults. Did kids love it? Absolutely. Was it attractive to kids? Definitely. It's not aimed at kids. It was not meant to be a kids movie. This is a film that was made for children whose parents have shown them the other films. Afterlife bridges the gap because it takes the older fans and introduces these kids, this torch passing that I hate in general, but I'll keep that aside. Into these kids who McKenna Grace is outstanding. I mean, really, if it weren't for her, this whole thing would not work. Because I mean, Podcast is adorable, but he's not really much in this film. Lucky, I'm sorry, darling, I forgot who you were. she showed up and I went, who's this? And then once Finn Wolfhard was all into her, I went, oh, that's right, I remember her. I don't care for Finn Wolfhard. I don't think he's really as exceptional as everyone seems to think he is. So now you only have the granddaughter of Egon Spengler. And if it weren't for her, the whole thing would fall apart, because as much as Paul Rudd tries, the dopey dad jokes don't always work. Carrie Coon is a placeholder. And you're right. Like the men who were the brilliance, and Annie Potts too, the original cast who were the brilliance behind this showed up, did their day, and went home. And unfortunately,
to a degree, I think that, I mean, in the third act, we do get some good moments, you know, where especially, you know, the Venkman type of moments and things like that. But yeah, with this huge cast, I mean, it felt at times like they were just juggling people's schedules. You know, it's like we've got Paul Rudd on these days, we've got Finn Wolfhard on these days, we've got Murray on these days. The ones that are in it the most throughout are McKenna Grace and Podcast. I forget the name of the kid that plays Podcast. Actually Dan Aykroyd. Aykroyd gets a lot of screen time in this. And even though he's not really there comedically, I did appreciate seeing him in a large role in a film, because he doesn't do that much anymore. And there was a certain charm to kind of the mentor student dynamic between Aykroyd and McKenna Grace. So I did enjoy that, even if he wasn't quite bringing the laughs.
I mean, I'm with you on that, go ahead.
No, sorry. He had a few good scenes with Ernie Hudson and Winston as well, which obviously there's the passing the torch, which I also agree. I'm not the biggest fan of this new trend of passing the torch to whomever, but I think Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson had a couple of really decent scenes, one in particular.
Yeah.
But they just got the talk. And sometimes, in my favourite thing in a film is when you get two good actors, just let them talk. Just give them some half-decent dialogue and just let them talk. And it almost felt like they were talking, you know, they were channelling some of their own experiences and feelings in those moments. So
I thought those
two were
this
great.
This is how they want to spend their golden years.
Yeah, that scene... I knew that was the scene you're talking about, and that's a very nice scene. I mean, that was – if there's any moments in this film that kind of tug at the heartstrings, that's one of them where you see these two guys who have been, you know, pals, partners for 40-some years. It kind of harkened me back to the scene that Winston and Ray have in the Ecto-1 in the original film where they're talking about –
the end of the world
and the Bible verses and that whole thing. And you just see this wonderful connection between Ray and Winston in that scene. And you get that again in that moment where Ray is telling him, but Winston, this is my thing. This is what I'm all about. This is how I want to spend my golden years. And, you know, maybe that tugged at me because I am getting older and all that kind of stuff. But I thought that was a very nice scene.
I mean, it tugged at me because Dan Aykroyd is speaking as Dan Aykroyd in that moment.
Oh,
he
yeah,
wants
absolutely.
To still be doing Ghostbusters movies in his golden years because that's what he's doing. Like, he isn't doing – he does other things on the side, but Dan Aykroyd as an individual has always been fascinated with the supernatural, and, like, he's got, like, family history and all this other stuff with it. But this has always been at his core. And so, like, I can see him coming back and just continuing to come back, even if it's not – well informed of a decision. I don't see Bill Murray coming back for another film. I don't see Annie Potts coming back for another film. I think Dan would come back, and I think Ernie Hudson would come back because Dan Aykroyd would convince him to come back. I think Dan Aykroyd would make 100 more of these if you let him, because I think he just can't put it aside. And it's like a weird bittersweet thing for me. His is one of the characters that makes a decision that's completely out of character for him. And so it just it bothered me.
Well, shall we get to that at this point? Let's talk about what you said there were two decisions. This is the first one that you're going to talk about. So what is it that Aykroyd's character does that you think is inconsistent with his character?
So Kumail Nanjiani comes into Ray Stantz's store with all of this stuff that he's trying to unload from his grandmother's apartment, and he wants to make some money off it. And one of the things is that Hellraiser orb. That it's like the Hellraiser Scrabble orb is what I kept calling it. And so it's this thing, and he takes one look at it. He takes the PKE. It breaks the PKE from all of the spiritual power coming off of it. And he's like, you know, this is one of those things that you don't open. Like, this is something that this is one of those items that you trap something in and want to keep it closed. And then later on.
And then turns it over to two characters.
He tosses it in a plastic bag and drops it on a shelf for people to open. No, I absolutely reject that. That Ray Stantz would have taken that with Egon. They would have been in a back room. They never would have opened this thing. They would have translated all of those words. They would have figured out what it was. They never would have just thrown it in a plastic bag like Nanjiani did, Nadim. And just dropped it somewhere like a piece of trash. And I understand that in a kid's movie, you need to move the plot along. And in kids' movies, adults make dumb decisions. I don't like this because this is never what Ray Stantz would have done, ever.
It did seem pretty casual the way they handled it after it having that dramatic moment where it breaks the detector. And he has such a strong reaction to it, and he warns people about it, and then, like he said, he walks away, and that doesn't make much sense. All right, well,
yeah,
go ahead.
Then we get this new ghost. What do they call it? The ghost unit they've got underneath this building, where it's this new containment unit. And
oh yeah, I've already forgotten what it's called.
Earlier on, I can't remember what it's called now, but I think you said, Richard, that. Or it might have been Todd. They're setting this up for a cinematic universe. They're trying to push this forward. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, okay, this is your kind of Avengers headquarters type place, and mm-hmm. got a little bit of a bad vibe about that.
Oh, the ghost transfer equipment, you know, where we're taking them out of the haunted objects. By the way, that was one of the best jokes in the movie. You know, it was haunted by an evil spin doctor CD.
Yeah.
Oh, I loved that. Yes. That was really
so
good.
There were occasional laughs, but I would agree that I think Todd said it. We've gone from something that is really a comedy to mostly what is a supernatural adventure, and it's a kid's supernatural adventure. Mm-hmm. And I can see
they're
that for sure.
I find is, and also just for anyone listening, I did actually enjoy this film. I might not sound like it, but they're telling more jokes now, whereas the first film, especially, hosted by, like we've said, on that incredible chemistry between the four of them, and the way they bounce off each other. Egon would say something, Venkman would maybe just shoot him a glance, or Ray would say something. Or that was where the jokes came from. It was
yeah.
a script, and it was a performance. Mm-hmm. Rather than now, it seems more like they're just throwing gags out there, which, you know, because if they don't hit, like some didn't, they clang a little bit more, I find.
Well, I think, what's his name, Kumail Nanjiani, did a nice job tossing in a few bon mots here and there. I, for instance, really appreciated that line. You know, thank you for asking. So many places do that without asking.
Oh, that was
I'm going, we need more of that kind of humor in it, where it's, people are just kind of reacting to the moment. They're not making an effort.
Yeah, that's him. I don't believe for a minute that was written. Right. That's Kumail Nanjiani being a brilliant improv actor and having that wit and being able to throw it back. And those are all of the lines that we remember from the original two films, the ones that were never originally scripted, the ones that they got because you had these incredibly talented actors and all of that chemistry, and they just played. You know, they weren't making a movie. They were playing on screen together.
It's a different tone, but what Nanjiani is bringing to this film is a similar vibe to what Moranis brought to the first one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I how dare I compare anyone to Moranis, because Moranis
he's got the pot on his head.
Yeah, but you know, it's that kind of character, you know, entering this dynamic here, and I appreciated what he brought. At first, it was kind of like, okay, it feels like this character is going to come in, introduce this this orb thing, and then he's gone. So he came back and then factors in, you know, in a pretty big way. And I was like, okay, I like this.
By the way, when I saw the movie the second time, I did see some of those foreshadowings that he was going to come back into the story that I hadn't noticed the first time through. And so there is... It doesn't really, on that second viewing, it didn't seem like they were just pushing things together. It did seem like there was a plan. I just think that it's so cluttered that you can't always tell what the plan was. And when we were mm-hmm. talking about clutter before, somebody was mentioning all the characters that they have in the film and trying to give everybody a chance to do something. Near the end, there's a scene, you know, obviously there's the confrontation scene at the end. And we have all of the Ghostbusters-type characters in the background. And I started counting, and I went, holy criminy, they've got a dozen people standing there on one side of the screen facing mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. That's the story that we're supposed to be paying attention to. And that just seems like it's a lot.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is. It felt like at times they'd had the characters from Afterlife and almost thought, well, you're in that film, we've kind of got to bring you over now, because I get why the Spenglers came home to New York, or came back to New York for to carry on Egon's legacy, but podcast, lucky. They're the kind of characters I thought that maybe they'd have stayed back home in Oklahoma. And then
lucky
especially
is particularly a stretch,
lucky,
I think.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Where she ends up and what she ends up doing in the film, it did that felt to me like, well, we like Celeste O'Connor, we don't want to, you know, brush it to the side. What can we do? I don't know, have her working in this super yeah. duper laboratory. Whereas podcast, I get, because he had that cool relationship with Ray at the end of Afterlife, and I liked him in this film, Logan Kim. I think he's got charm for days, but
yeah.
It did feel so underutilized. And then Finn Wolfhard as well, I like him, didn't really have much to do. There's a lot of things you've kind of cut out where you wouldn't then have 12 Busters at the end of the film, and you got to fit them all in somehow, and they tried, and yeesh, didn't always work.
Right. It was podcast, really wedged.
Podcast coming into things in the sequel here, I get, because like you said, he has a moment with Ray at the end of the Afterlife. He is kind of the same mindset as Ray. You know, he's the conspiracy theorist type of guy and all that. And the fact that he would kind of latch onto Ray and come out and work with Ray to create a podcast type of thing, I was buying that. So and plus it was good to have him there because he does have such a great dynamic with McKenna Grace's character. You know, in Afterlife they were great together, and in this film they're great together. And I mean, I don't. We've talked about a lot of different characters and things, and I don't want to, change McKenna Grace. I think that Phoebe, when it comes to the reboot films or legacy films, whatever you want to call this iteration of Ghostbusters. You know, they wisely realize she's the heart and soul of this. And, for some of the areas where the film falls a bit short, I think if they continue to focus on her character, there's going to be a certain strength to it, because Phoebe is just a great character, period. You know, in both films here, I think she's a fantastic character.
They just need to make sure that she makes consistent decisions.
Yeah, I knew that was going to be your next one.
Well, let's go there.
This child would never have climbed into that contraption. Absolutely not. I was almost yelling in the theater. There is no way this child, who knows what she knows about all of this science and all of this theory and all of this, absolutely not would she have done that. I don't care if she has a crush on Melody. I don't care if she's no. There is absolutely no way she ever would have done such a thing. I'm sorry. That was the one that drove me absolutely crazy, because she never. Finn Wolfhard would have done it. But I think what they're doing, and I see it and I can appreciate it, but it doesn't work. They're trying to make sure they open up their representation here. They're making sure that Phoebe has got a cute little thing for Melody, and that's very sweet, and she's feeling isolated, and she feels like she can connect here. Great. She never would have climbed into that machine.
Yeah. Well, did it go against the rules of that they set up in the film? So I'm pretty sure they said they couldn't do that half an hour before, but yeah, I'm with you on that.
Well, they had never tried.
That's par for the course for the series. I mean, you can't cross the streams either. So,
exactly.
It just felt a little bit. I know people have made the comparison to Casper the Friendly Ghost, which I see. It just felt kind of too wacky for me, where she's like, I can go into this machine. I'll be back in 2 minutes, don't worry, but my spirit's going to leave my body. I'm going to cross it. Oh, man. And I totally agree. The whip smart character we saw in Afterlife and in this one as well before that, I can't in a million years see her ever doing that. I get, like you say, young love, young emotion, she's feeling ostracized and there's emotions for days, but I don't know, it just seemed like something that needed to happen, but we've got to try and we've got to weave everything together, so how about this? But yeah, I that was the one moment where one of the moments in amongst a lot that I did like, where I thought, I just wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah, it's what makes the whole thing, like, I am great at suspension of disbelief. Nope, I can't accept that moment. I can't.
You know, one of the things you're saying about kind of the comparisons to Casper and that, one of the things that these two more recent films have done that I'm kind of, unsure completely how I feel about it, is this idea of, again, the ghost.
The ghost has personalities and characters as opposed to merely antagonists,
Yeah, and, I mean, the original films, it was never that, this was so-and-so. There may be a little bit, but in a monstrous kind of way. Like in Ghostbusters 2, you have the Scolari brothers,
Oh, I love the Scolari brothers.
But they're not presented as in a way where they look like actual people, and that. And, the ghosts were always like Slimer and, that type of thing. And granted, we opened the door in Afterlife because we had the Harold Ramis thing. Mm-hmm. But here now we've got this other ghost, this other teenage girl, and is the only character in the whole thing ghost-wise that is like, you know, was an actual person type thing. Everybody else is like, you know, this sewer monster, and there's this little booger thing that spits at you, you know, and there's the possessor, which I like the possessor. The possessor is cool.
The possessor is great.
But, you know, there's this weird fuzziness between, you know, ghosts that were actual people and seem to look and behave the way they did when they were actual people, and then ghosts that are just weird slime burping things, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, it's an odd balance that I'm not sure they're quite pulling off here yet.
No. Well, they need something cute. They need something to produce for merchandise. Again, it's a kid's movie. Like, they have to have the little baby Stay Puffs. They have to have the minions. Little booger monster. Yeah, like, they need to have, they need the puke joke. You gotta have a puke joke if it's gonna be a Ghostbusters movie, apparently. Like, it's stuff like that that just, it makes me feel too old. And if I'm too old for this movie, then it's not a Ghostbusters movie, because that was meant for adults. Like, I don't know. Like, there are great, great, great kids movies out there. I mean, the trailer for Despicable Me 4 was on this, and I'm thrilled about that because I think those movies are hilarious. Like, you can do kids movies without dumbing it down. And I just feel like they're starting to get cheap with some of these jokes and some of these ideas. And it just depresses me, really.
I have a limited amount of patience for the Minions. You know, I was worried a bit that they were, you know, that the little Stay Puffs were going to be just showing up throughout this doing the Minions mm-hmm. shtick. And when they are there, it is the Minions shtick.
Yep.
But they don't overuse them. And I was kind of like, you know, if this was the kind of stuff we were getting out of the Minions in those Despicable Me movies, I'd probably like them better. Mm-hmm. Because the stuff that the little Stay Puffs do are actually quite funny. Yes. In this.
The pencil sharpener is my favorite. Excellent. I was pretty good with that.
My favorite is in the mid-credits scene where the one Stay Puff has his face in the cigarette lighter thing.
Yes.
Do you think anybody who is watching this movie knows what the cigarette lighter joke is?
Oh, God, that's the other point. See, again, they're trying to drag the adults along with them.
That's a great point, man. I did like the mini puffs at the end when Podcast is going to be the hero. He's going to get that drone and capture the bad guy, Garaka, in it, and the mini puffs come and start attacking them again, as they did in Afterlife. I thought that was a fun callback, and I went to watch this with my kid, who is turning 8 next month, and she had a blast. She was scared by it.
Of course,
oh, sure, yeah.
And so I kind of, when I was watching it, as you know, however old I am now, kind of guy, thinking, I wish this felt more like the film I wanted to be. You know, I looked down, I was like, oh, she's having a great time. She's dancing away, she's laughing, she's giggling away. So to your point, yeah, I mean, it absolutely is a kid's franchise now. But it seems to work, and I'm interested to see how well this does financially. But I've seen a few people say, you know, they took their kids and they really enjoyed it. So that is a good thing. But I also, you don't have to dumb it down, which I do think that, to the point we've all made now about the gags, is that I think they can still write better jokes. They can still write funnier sequences. But there was still a lot in here that I did find funny. A lot of what Podcast did was funny. I liked the Slimer and Trevor being Wallpart stuff and how mm-hmm. that paid off. With
I know that guy. Slimer.
Yeah, exactly.
But that did get a laugh out of me. So when it worked, this film, I thought there were some really great moments in it. It's just sat there too sporadic. They're too put it all over the place. And I don't know about you guys, but if you're going to get someone to do exposition, you get Patton Oswalt.
And you know what's funny about him? Like, I loved him in this. I loved that, like, this is so cool. Like, I thought he was wonderful. His character, had this been a drama, it would have been Vincent D'Onofrio. I love that weirdo professor character who's just a total nerd for the sake of being a nerd. Like, these are my people. And I thought he was wonderful. And then just everything that started getting serious and he's making it goofy, I'm like, this would have been D'Onofrio. And it still would have been wonderful.
Yep.
I was relieved after Patton Oswalt's stuff because I'm not a fan of him.
No. Interesting.
He rubs me the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. And, you know, so when I heard he was going to be in this, I was like, oh, no, please, not to my Ghostbusters. But, you know, he shows up. He's got a quirky little part that fits him, mm-hmm. and he does his duty, and
it's one
gone.
Scene. One scene.
And yep. I'm like, that's all right, needed. I'm okay with that. So
yeah. It's funny because I got to the point – it was last Sunday. I went to go see Dune Part 2, and they played a trailer for Frozen Empire, and it went on for 3 days. I'm like, this is the longest trailer, and I was having such a hard time blocking it out because I had gotten to the point where I was starting to recognize voices in the trailers, and Patton Oswalt was the voice I had recognized. I'm like, I don't want to know these people are in it. But, like, these kinds of things, you start getting so much in the trailer, and everything is revealed to you, and then you start figuring out the plot, right? So mm-hmm. it's like with Patton Oswalt, you know what he's going to turn into. He turns into exactly this guy. So I agree with you. Like, his role here was wonderful. It was just what it needed to be. It helped explain everything, but it didn't feel heavy-handed.
I will tell you, though, too, that scene with him and Aykroyd – at the library.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, for a moment, I mean, we're well past the spoiler wall here, you know.
Yeah,
but...
go ahead, everybody, by the way, those of you listening, if you hadn't realized, we've crossed the line a couple of times. We are now officially a mile past the line. And so whatever we talk about from now on is likely to disclose something that maybe you didn't want to know. Yeah. Go ahead.
But so, you know, we have the callback to the lions out in front of the library, and the possessor goes into the one lion. And I seriously, for a moment there, I was like, are they going to kill Ray? They might kill Ray.
Oh, no.
And I, you know, I was like, no, they really can't do it. But I was nervous for a moment there.
Oh, wow. I never had that thought at all. I was just in my glory for that entire library sequence. I want to know why John Rothman didn't get a shout out in the credits at the end when they were talking about, like, special appearances by. Because when Ray shows up in his little Ecto-C, I don't know what the hell they called it. His weird little – his motorcycle. I can't remember what those are called specifically.
But the sidecar.
Sidecar. So he parks there, and they're like, is this parking? That's all right. They know me here. And Rothman comes, no. I was roaring. I'm like, thank you so much for still having this guy. This is amazing.
That's not allowed with this place,
so that was great. Oh,
that's
and
one
then
of those moments where I'm the only one in the theater. I go, oh! And,
you know,
and people are like, what is he reacting to? And I'm like, come on,
that.
It's the same guy from 40 years ago.
Normally, I do that because I'm reacting to stuff that's in trailers that everybody else has seen except me. But I love when they go down to, like, the real library, and they're down in the stacks where they were in the first film. I was looking for the stack of books. I'm still happy we didn't get it. But, like, the library ghost was there. I was so excited for that. Like, that I will absolutely eat up that kind of fan service. It's mm-hmm. just little things. They're there for a reason. They're there to see Patton Oswalt. But you have Rothman. You have the library ghost. You have those same stacks. I was in for it. I'm like, this is delightful. And then I got a kick out of the possessor taking that lion out. I was like, oh, let's go with this. This is fun. I'm sorry that you felt that, because I was like riding the wave of that whole sequence.
I mean, it was a fun sequence, but I was just, you know, so many times when we get into these, you know, these legacy sequels or these cinematic universes and such, people seem to be clamoring for characters to get killed off.
Yeah.
I mean, every Marvel movie that comes out nowadays, people are like, oh, they got to kill somebody. We got to have somebody die.
I don't need Han Solo, like, getting a lightsaber through.
No,
you know,
you don't need to always kill somebody off. But there was a part of me that thought, I mean, is Rey about to enter?
Yep.
I can't see a world where they kill any of these guys off, because Ghostbusters, man, you can't kill Ray, you can't kill Winston, you can't kill Peter. I mean, with obviously Egon, real world, incidents has made that a necessity, but I can't imagine them ever. Surely they've got to keep the Ghostbusters alive forever. However, I don't know how many more the OGBs are going to do. They're going to be back again and again because I still think they're going to continue the story on. But
you can kill off Melissa McCarthy or those.
Oh, as often as not Kate McKinnon though. Keep her.
No, I'm with you. I mean, we talked about this.
I'd be down for her to show up for this.
You know, I mean, I like Kate McKinnon in that
anything.
Movie, but Melissa McCarthy, I can't. She's up there with Patton Oswalt for me. I'm not a fan.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other discussion. In fact, I was on that one, I'm pretty sure. But
We've hashed through these movies a bunch of times.
God, I just can't help it. But I don't know. Like, I love Janine. I love Annie Potts as Janine. I think she's amazing. She does not belong in a flight suit. She had the proton power glove. What was that thing? Like, that was silly.
That was actually kind of similar to something. I was like, was that out of the 2016 film? Because I think they had something like that in that movie.
Yeah, they did.
Oh, I didn't like it. And then she didn't need to be in the flight suit. It was just, it was weird. No. I didn't like her in a flight suit in Ghostbusters 2. Like, no, you're Janine. You're supposed to be snarky, get behind the desk, like, answer the phone and, like, kick people's asses. Like, that's what you do.
Yeah, because you're not somebody's mother.
I don't know. She didn't fit that for me then. She doesn't fit for me now. I like that she's working with Winston. I kind of want her to be like, you know, the person in charge of everything and telling Pinfield to go get his butt back into the lab or something. Like, she needs to be running the show, not, you know, suiting up. It
not
just didn't work for
ghosts.
Me. Yep.
Well, and while we're on the subject of, you know, other characters coming back, I mean, while I appreciated William Atherton back as Peck, Peck has lost some of his edge, I think, in this, you know, so I wanted him to be, you know, just, you know, I mean, I wanted him to be just more motivated.
Awful.
I think that, you know, this is my chance to finally get payback for 40 years ago, you know.
Right.
I had a really good point at one point. He's like, you have a minor on the outside of the car. I'm like, he's got you there, guys. You can't get out of that one. But they never go anywhere.
Right.
And at the end, when Venkman, and man, I love Venkman. I love Venkman anyway. His line to Peck when he sees him, he just says, "You clown."
Yes.
I thought, man, that's different to what you said 40 odd years ago. So going back to them dumbing it down a little bit.
Well, somebody I was talking to, a friend of mine, says that somebody in the crowd shouts it.
Yes. Yes.
And I missed that.
Yeah, I missed it too. Well, it should have been Venkman saying, "Hey, Dickless."
You can't in a kid's movie.
You know.
It's there.
Not anymore. Yeah. You know,
you
like
listen,
that's the problem. I liked him here. I got spoiled on him. I would have loved to have not known he was in this, but I was scrolling and somebody had a side by side photo of him then and him now, and I went, "Ah, damn it, I know what's happening." I do wish, like you, that he had been a little bit more slimy, but I did get a little chill when he was like, "I've been waiting 40 years," and I'm like, "Oh, guy, good for you. I love this." A friend of mine was aggravated. He wanted Peck to be more true to his environmental position, to his job as mayor, and he wanted him to be more fighting for the city kind of stuff. Which I thought was an interesting point of view. It's not mine, but I thought it was something cool to bring up here. Like, he just thought that this whole "I'm the slimy guy with my axe to grind" wasn't good enough for what the mayor should have been doing.
Well, I never got the impression from the first film that Peck was really all that much of an environmentalist. He's an opportunist. You know, he's
a bureaucrat who's addicted to power, which is exactly what he turns into as mayor of New York, you know, another bureaucrat addicted to power and trying to use whatever structures he can to get back at his enemies. And I think that's probably that we needed just a little bit more of that to. There's so many of these things in this film where we needed just a little bit more to make it work. A little bit more with Peck would have been great. Paul Rudd falls short he just doesn't get as much to do as he needs to do. I'm sorry, I needed more of Phoebe's science jokes.
Yeah.
What did we get? Yes. One or well, two?
And there are hints of a. I found it interesting the moments where it's kind of Paul Rudd and McKenna Grace trying to come to terms with, okay, is he a part of the family? Is yes. he dad now? Is he, you know, and you know, it was actually very genuine, kind of the struggle there between this guy who's come into the family and this teenage girl who's you know, at a point of great confusion in her life and all that. I was like, okay, this is actually an interesting real world subplot here. Mm-hmm. They don't go far enough with it.
Yep, I agree. Yep. I agree. Yeah, because they really are like they were the heart of Afterlife. You know, like you've got the guy who was the bridge who's showing them the YouTube videos of what happened back in 84. You've got, you know, Phoebe figuring out who she is, this little science geek who's kind of ostracized. But guess what? She's, you know, the granddaughter of this legend, as far as I'm concerned. You know, and then they come here and they kind of have to figure out this new familial relationship, which is great. You know, I don't know. I felt that some of the lines that Paul Rudd had were, like you guys said, they did not work. They really landed like a rock. But a couple of them, it almost gut me. Like it was that the more I say this, eventually you're going to start laughing because it's going to get this. So like when he was goofing with Callie in their bedroom and he was like saying the lyrics of the song to her. I mean, I rolled my eyes so hard I could see my brain, but by the end, I was like, all right, stop. Stop it. You're starting to make me laugh now.
I mean, that moment was in all the trailers, and yet it was one of the biggest laugh moments in the theater that I was with. I think part of it is it's charming, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a big deal here. I think because it is Paul Rudd, I don't think anybody else could do it. I think it's because of his specific charm. I think it's because he's so likable in general, you know, as a person and as an actor, I think. I think that's why all of this works. Like, we buy him in this role as the dorky teacher and as now the awkward stepdad. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the trailer, can I shift our points of view for a second?
Sure.
Because I would like to bring up the fact that for a movie so focused on the next Ice Age and the big bad, we're not talking about him at all. But also the fact, I mean, we haven't talked about this because clearly he's not any good. He's not that interesting. Where he had the potential, like those horns really should have been good. The glowy eyes should have been spectacular. I mean, Todd, you talk about seeing Ghostbusters 2 in the theater. I saw it in the theater too. I was 10. I begged my mother to leave. Because Janosch's glowing eyes scared the hell out of me. So when I was a kid, I was scared of everything. I don't know how I became the horror fiend that I am. But we left in the middle of the movie because I couldn't do it. This guy with the glowing eyes should have been terrifying, and he was fluff. And in the trailer that I watch the trailers when I get into the car after the film. One of the trailers literally says in words across the screen, every ghost they've ever caught will be unleashed. And it doesn't happen. I was waiting. I'm like, if you guys are going to give me that, if I had seen that before this movie, I would have been really angry because that did not happen. It just doesn't.
I tell you, the big, you know, showdown in the third act as such, where, you know, the ice all comes.
It's 15 minutes of this movie.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, you know, I really think that it was a missed opportunity to not have that happen midway through the film, because there's just so many possibilities with, you know, send the crew out to try and bust all kinds of ghosts as you're sliding around on ice-covered streets with you know, these ice spikes jumping out of the ground and
was
all that
kind
of stuff.
Was no one killed by those, by the way?
It doesn't appear that. Single death. You know, well, it seems
again,
strange.
Again, kids' movie.
Yeah. You know, exactly, Todd.
But, you know, there's just so much potential with, you know, with Ghostbusters on ice to make it only the last 15 minutes of the movie.
I'll pay for that. You know.
That's the one we need. Ghostbusters on ice.
I'd go for that.
The villain is was something. What I loved about the villains in, this is one of the things I loved about the villains in part in Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2, is they're played by people. They're played by real people at Tangerville on set. With this, obviously, it's a 8-foot-tall, millennia-old demon god. You can't really get somebody, maybe Javier Bartek could have jumped in, but I didn't feel the threat just because it didn't feel real enough. And
there's no personality. There's no character there. It's just a...
Exactly. The vision. He knew where to get the horns from, but then didn't know who the Firemaster was. Like, with, you know, are you smart or are you not? And in the trailer, actually, there's a few scenes that are, I mean, this is commonplace, but there was a scene in the trailer of all of the new Busters with these really boss, really cool red jackets on.
I want one.
That's not in the, that's not in the film. Lucky has one on, but it's not there. Peck says something like, the Ghostbusters, that they're bad guys, blah, blah, blah. There was no witnesses to what happened before. That's not in. I wonder if this film went through a little bit of a shake-up during it, because there's a few things in the trailer which I was quite looking forward to seeing, and they weren't in there. Yeah, that trailer, that is, it does go heavy, doesn't it, on that, on the Frozen Empire aspect. It takes an hour and a half for you to get there, and that's the problem. And if everything before that is great, not so bothered. But... obviously, the disjointed direction to get there. Then by the end, I thought, I don't really buy the bad guy. I'm not really that worried by the bad guy. And then there was something about dipping part of a proton pack in brass, and a guy with and a guy with flick flames through his hands. At that point, I was starting to get a little bit, what the hell is going on? I don't know what's going on anymore. But I still wasn't bored. I still didn't dislike it. It just... didn't feel like the Ghostbusters I saw when I was a kid. But
it
then
was
the
just too fast.
Well, that's what I was saying earlier when I saw it the second time. It was a lot easier for me to process some of the things and appreciate what was going on, and it made a little bit more sense, and there were places where the jokes landed a little bit better. I think it's going to grow on people. I don't think it's going to be dismissed immediately. You know, people are going to see it and enjoy it. It's going to do its business, but I think in the long run, it's going to gain in reputation. It's you know, its initial perception, it doesn't seem to me like anybody is jumping up and saying, oh, this is, you know, on a par with any of the other films. It's just another entry. It's just another piece of the franchise that they're plugging away at. I think its reputation will grow a little.
I mean, it'll be like Ghostbusters 2 that grew cult following. That's what it'll be. There's an article floating around. I already forgot who wrote it, and it's not a bad article. It's just my brain doesn't hold on to things anymore. That talks about, like, the ranking of all five Ghostbusters films, and he ranks Ghostbusters 2 as his favorite. And it's a charming article. Yeah, it's a very charming article. And he's like, I don't want to hear it from you. I'm right. I don't care what you say. It's really funny. But he's like, this is the one. He says, this is the one that where they found this. They did this. It was great. And I agree with them. You know, I love Ghostbusters too. I think it's wonderful. You know, you carry on. I mean, I'm constantly yelling quotes about Vigo at people because this is who I am. But I think this will kind of gain that kind of traction. For me, I hope this is the last one, and I don't think it's going to be. I know there's a Netflix version coming.
It won't be. I mean, I think it is interesting, just, you know, the comparisons to Ghostbusters 2. I mean, Ghostbusters 2 definitely grew on me. Like I said, when I first saw it in the theater, it was kind of like, okay, that was all right, you know. And over the years, I've gone, you know, there's a lot of cleverness about Ghostbusters 2. It does something that I appreciate in a lot of second part sequels, which is where they go nuts. I mean, like the Statue of Liberty thing is just nuts. And you're absolutely right, Lisa, that, I mean, I think Ghostbusters 2 may be the scariest of them. I mean, you know, Vigo gets scared. The moment when Ray gets possessed by Vigo in the conclusion of Ghostbusters 2 freaked me out. You know, I mean, Ghostbusters 2 over the course of, you know, 35 years, I think has a better reputation now than it did when it was first released. And I could see that happening with this one somewhat. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think it's inevitable. I think we'll be back again. Yep. I don't know that, you know, we're necessarily going to see the same, you know, the same involvement of the legacy characters. I think, like you were saying earlier, I think Aykroyd Murray. And Hudson are the biggest bets for coming back again for more.
I'm sorry, but, Vickman gets the views.
Murray's done.
True.
Well, he's going to be done. I mean, I love that he wore his orange jacket. That made me happy. But it's like that moment, it's like, you know, that's Venkman on the other side of that door when they're like all creeped out because somebody's knocking at the door. It's like, of course it's Venkman. Who else is that going to be? But I don't know. I just feel like, you know, having a cameo to force fan service is not going to work forever.
Yeah.
The ending of Afterlife, like dare say, could have also been the perfect ending for the OG characters.
Yes.
They came back for one last blast. They took out Gozer. They did it for their buddy Egon, and then they went to live happy ever after, retired, doing whatever. But like you said, they bring in the money.
Yes, and that's what's happening now. You know, like, I think what makes, because I sobbed through Afterlife. I cried through the whole damn thing. I mean, people like crying at the end. I mean, Egon is running across the field to get to his house. You've got what's his name, who played the warden in Shawshank Redemption.
Bob Gunton.
Thank you. I saw him and I started. Like, I'm not kidding when I say I cried through the whole thing. This one, I was fine until I saw For Ivan at the end, and then I'm getting choked up now. But the idea of that film. That was the legacy film. That was the one that, you know, was all heart. And what I think was really good about it was you have Jason Reitman at the helm. You know, it's like you've got Jason Reitman working with Ivan Reitman. You've got Phoebe Spangler and Egon. You've got all the old guys coming back with the new guys. And I thought that that was so wonderfully structured. I loved that they brought back Gozer. I thought Olivia Wilde did a great job in that moment. Like, I just thought there was so much heart to that one. That this one, you've got this extra person who did help with Afterlife. He did, like, help write it. I feel like something got lost in this story when Ivan Reitman passed. And I feel like there was something there that maybe Jason Reitman couldn't stick with it because of grief. I don't know. I just feel like there's something missing from this one that we just didn't get, that we did get so well in the last one.
All right. Well, let's see. You know, what is it they say? What helps me hear things is silence. The silence here seems to indicate that we are at a point where we can maybe do a summary here. If you want to rank your Ghostbusters films and give us a recommendation, we're not doing lamb scores per se, but you know, if you can give a recommendation to fans or some kind of reason why they should or shouldn't see it in a theater, I think that's how we'll finish up here. So, Matt, let's start with you. Would you recommend this to people? How would you place it in the pantheon of Ghostbusters films, that sort of thing?
I'm always going to – I am that kind of guy. I'm always going to recommend the Ghostbusters film because I want people to see it. I love Ghostbusters, and I want more people to share that. So I am going to recommend this. I've been negative about this film for the majority of the pod, but I still had a good time with it. It's just the thing stood out for me more than I wish that they had done. So I'm still going to recommend it, absolutely. And, yeah, if you've got kids, I think they're going to really dig this. There are some scenes that they might find a little bit scary. But I'm going to recommend this if you are an OG hardcore fan, temper expectations, maybe. And in terms of rankings, mine is 1, 2, 3, 4, 1984, 89, Afterlife, and then this one. Though Afterlife and 2 do switch places sometimes. So, whilst this is bottom of my rankings, I still don't think it's a terrible film by any means.
Fair enough. Lisa, how about you?
Yes, go see it in the theater because I have a different point of view on things. Everybody else that has kind of shown up on my posts and has like made posts of their own, everybody else is enjoying the hell out of it. You know, I think I'm looking for something different. I don't want a kids movie. I don't have kids. But I do know that people who have kids have brought them and they're enjoying it. And I think that's a great thing. I think that's wonderful for them. You know, in the ranking, obviously, for me, I mean, it's going to be 1, 2, Afterlife, then this, and then that 2016 thing will be ranked at number 52. I just, but, you know, like, it's going to be always, you know, 1, 2, 3 is going to be Afterlife is number 3 for me. It's a good film. It's not as good as it should have been for me, but it's something that, because it's in the theater, because people show up for it, it means that we'll get more movies in the theater, and I want to keep that going.
Well, I appreciate that you are enthusiastic about the film, and I think it's also a good thing that you didn't have kids, because some poor kid out there would have been stuck with the name Egon, and he would have been traumatized his whole life as a result.
I'm a teacher. You know I would never give a kid a name that would be so strange. No. Oh, my gosh. Harold, maybe. But
Todd, it's your turn.
I always say that, you know, I'm a little bitter because my wife wouldn't let me name my son Obi-Wan. So, you know, but that's another story. No, I agree with what everyone's saying here. I would recommend the film. I still had a great night at the movies going to see this, you know, despite its flaws. You know, it was still a fun experience. Go see it in the theater. You know, as far as ranking goes, I mean, the original is the tops, of course. I'm going to put Afterlife slightly above Ghostbusters 2, and then I'd put this one, and then, of course, the film that we shall not name. So,
he who shall not be named, you know, that sort of thing. Yes, I know exactly what you mean, and I'm I think exactly where everybody else is. I would recommend this film. I think the more you see it, the more you'll enjoy it. I do think that it is the least of the films of the Ghostbusters films that I would recommend, but that doesn't mean that it's not worth seeing. And it is worth seeing, and as always, I want people to see movies in the theater. So make sure you do that. Apparently Lisa's got a lot of trailers going on in her head, despite the fact that she doesn't watch trailers. I heard you mention it three times after today in today's show, and one of them was an afterwing. That Minions trailer, or the Despicable Me trailer that you mentioned, you sound like you suffered through it.
I didn't watch it. I could hear it.
I've always wondered what you do to block them out in the theater.
Oh,
like, are
Todd,
you sitting there
laughed.
In the fetal position, you know, with your fingers in your ears, humming the Star Spangled Banner? I mean, what do you do?
Todd, that's exactly what
My
I do.
My eyes see the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Usually what I do is, so I'll watch the first couple of seconds of the trailer until I can see somebody I can identify, and then I look up their movies on IMDb, and I see what's coming out, and I match to whatever it is. And on IMDb, it'll tell you the movie release date. So I put that in my little calendar, and then I go back to what I'm doing. I'm usually reading. I have books in my Kindle app, so I'm sitting there reading a book while these trailers are running. Mm. Last week at Dune, when this thing came on, my husband was with me. He, like, literally had my thumbs in my ears, and I was singing I'm Henry VIII, I Am, because it just kept going. And I'm like, why won't this stop? Because if I'm a visual person. So if I see the trailer, I'm going to remember it. If I hear it, I'm less likely to retain it. But because this trailer has been everywhere recently, that's when I was able to identify Patton Oswalt. I was starting to pay attention to things that, like, Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray and Paul Rudd were saying in this. And I'm like, I'm starting to figure out too much about this plot. But yeah, I don't look. I sit at my phone, and I'll distract myself. But yeah, stuff like, I'm just so glad this blackout has been lifted now, because it gets exhausting when it's a film I'm really excited about, like this. Like, I can't know about this because I want to make sure I enjoy it as much as possible. And so at least I don't have to do this anymore. It's so tiring.
Yeah, a very appropriate song choice there, Lisa, because as we all know, I Am Henry VIII, I Am is a favorite song of Ghosts.
Oh,
the
God.
The first.
Oh, that was so great.
Swayze cover version.
It is. Oh, God, that movie. God, how amazing. But yeah, like, that literally is what I typically do. And so people think I'm nuts, but I don't care, because my enjoyment of the movie is going to be so good, because I won't know what's happening. You know, I mean, Hereditary alone was just this mind blowing experience for me, because I didn't have the faintest idea what was going to be happening.
Well, we'll have a little more trailer talk here in the second part of the show. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear from a fellow LEM Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our exit question of the week.
Hi, I'm Jason Soto.
And I'm Lisa Leahy.
And we're the host of Between the Scares, a podcast that takes a look at every movie that Blumhouse Productions has made. You may not recognize the name, but they have made some of your favorite horror movies like Paranormal Activity, Ouija, and Insidious.
Yeah, Jason, but they've also made stupid movies like The Fever and Best Night Ever and Hysterical Blindness.
Yeah, those two. But they also did Whiplash, Get Out, and Us, and we're going to cover it all.
Hey, did you know that Jason Blum also produced that Gem and the Holograms live-action movie?
He did that?
Uh-huh.
Ugh. Fine. But then you have to watch The Green Inferno. So listen to Between the Scares on Anchor, Apple, Google, Amazon, or our home location at rabbitholepodcast.com.
We're back, and it's time for our exit question of the week. This week, we were talking about the movie Ghostbusters After, not Afterlife, Frozen Empire. I knew I was going to get there eventually. And I thought about all of the actors that have been in these films. We've had, we've got a legacy cast, we've got a new cast that's going in. And so it's a lot of opportunities to think about films that people have been in. So that's the way I work the question of the week here. Picking any of the cast from either the old or the new cast, recommend three films from that actor and why we should see them. So hopefully everybody came up with some recommendations that we'll find interesting and worth exploring. Matt, we're going to start with you. What actor, what performer in these films have you picked on, and what films do you think we should see of theirs?
All right. Well, I didn't go with the obvious because I thought, well, I don't know who's going to go for Bill Murray and that. So I picked Carrie Coon. And the three films I've picked, one of them, she's in it, but she's not a huge role, but I just want more people to see it, is Widows. I think Widows was such a good film from 2018. And she has a smaller role in it, but she's in it. So I'm counting it. The Widows is the first one. I think that film is just incredibly good. And then the other two, the first one is a film called The Nest, which is it's a period piece set in the 80s, but it tells the story of a family that has to move around a lot. It stars Carrie Coon and Jude Law. And it's not quite a chamber piece, but it's like I said earlier, you get a couple of good actors, you give them some good dialogue, and you set the scene well. And you get a really tense, thrilling picture. So The Nest is the second one. And the final one for me is a film called The Keeping, which is it's a ghost story. And like Lisa, I am a huge horror head. So any kind of anything scary, anything chilling, I'm here for. And she stars with Lee Pace in this film.
I like him.
I don't want to give too much away about it. He's great in this. I don't want to give too much away, but yeah, it's just a really, really well written, well performed, well executed film. So The Keeping, The Nest, and Widows is the Carrie Coon unrelated trilogy I'm going for.
All right. Well, I like that there's a ghost story in there too for us.
Yeah, I'll be checking that out later. I don't know that one.
Todd, it's your turn.
Well, I decided to go with Dan Aykroyd. Because I was glad, like I said, to see him take on a larger role in this one. So the first one is pretty obvious, and it's the Blues Brothers.
Yes.
Because I grew up in the Chicago area, and the Blues Brothers is the quintessential Chicago film for me. I always call it an epic musical comedy, and it is kind of on the scale of like a cinematic epic, just where they go with this film. I could watch the Blues Brothers over and over and over again, and have many times. So, slightly deeper cut, I decided to go with Dragnet from 1987.
Yes.
Aykroyd playing the nephew of the original Joe Friday. You know, it's always funny how they have, you know, these nephews and such in movies. You know, Donald Duck has three nephews. You know, he doesn't have any kids, but he has nephews. One of the great charms of Dragnet, I think, is the way that it honors the original show, but also is very playful in the way it kind of pokes fun at it. The script is a lot of fun. Aykroyd wrote it. But I mean, one of the great things about it is just the wonderful dynamic between Aykroyd and Tom Hanks in the film. Tom Hanks pretty much steals the show. So yeah, another great one.
Yeah, don't and forget then, the Virgin Connie Swales.
Yeah. and then the last one I'm going to go with Sneakers, which is a film that I loved back when it came out, and I think a lot of people have forgotten about this one. It's got beyond, you know, just Aykroyd, it's got a great cast. I mean, Robert Redford, Ben Kingsley, River
Sydney
Phoenix,
Poitier.
Sidney Poitier, David Strathairn, Mary McDonnell. It's a great team type of a movie. All, you know, they're all very interesting characters that have interesting roles within this group, but Aykroyd is probably my favorite, playing a character that is probably not unlike, you know, Aykroyd himself, you know, a little bit of the conspiracy theorist and type of thing. His character is named Mother, which I love that name for him. And yeah, so Sneakers is one that I think too many people have forgotten since 1992. So go watch Sneakers.
Solid. Lisa, you've got you got the floor.
So yeah, I was careful. I was like, all right, I have to make sure I have backups in case people take this or take that. So I've got movies for Aykroyd, I've got movies for Hudson, and I've got movies for Weaver. So I think I'm gonna go with Ernie Hudson though. And don't get mad at me because I cheated a little bit and I went with Oz, which is a TV series in which he plays the warden. It's an HBO show, and it's so, 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 so good. It's one of those early HBO TV series about, you know, prison system. And basically every character actor you can think of from television is in this show, and they are astonishing, every single one of them. Basically any Law & Order character you've ever seen is in this show as well. But I think he's amazing in it. I think that show is just outstanding, and it's one of those shows I revisit frequently because it's just so amazing and so good. And have I mentioned it's amazing? Another movie is Leviathan, which is this sort of abyss-like horror undersea kind of movie, and you've got these deep sea miners, and they, you know, encounter a horrible creature. It's like this mutant thing that's some experiment gone wrong kind of thing. And I found this movie when I was a kid. I would like wander. This is when like they had the video rental shelves in the supermarket. And basically while my parents were checking out at the supermarket, I would go wander and look and see things. And I found it there and just kind of was like, ooh, you know, sea monster movie. Let's watch this. And I've just always had this affinity for it. And I think it's kind of a forgotten film. Everybody thinks deep sea horror, you're either going to go to Deep Blue Sea, shout out, or you know, the abyss. And I think Leviathan tends to have gotten swept under the rug.
Leviathan was part of one of those waves where you get two or three films in the same wheelhouse coming out within a short time of one another. We had Deep Star 6, Leviathan, and The Abyss all coming out, I think, within 6 months of each other, and they all had this undersea kind of monster sort of thing that vibed to them, and it's easy for one of them to get forgotten, and
that makes sense.
Even the Abyss, Leviathan, which is probably the one that's best remembered, is not really well remembered.
Yeah, Leviathan is kind of, you could describe it as basically combining at what were at the time Cameron's two latest films. It's Aliens meets the Abyss, basically.
It's true. You know, I mean, I didn't see it for at least 1 or 2 years after it came out because, again, any horror movies would have scared me at the time it was actually out. But it's just one of those things that I found on video and have just kind of really loved. The other one is The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, which is one of those fabulous 90s thrillers that I wish we still had. But if they even tried, it wouldn't be the same. So I'm just going to keep it as is. But, you know, this amazing film that – it is really about, you know, the two parents and the babysitter they get in. You've got Annabelle Sciorra, you've got Matt McCoy, and you've got Rebecca De Mornay as this woman named Peyton who comes in to care for their baby and, you know, this sort of horrible situation. But Ernie Hudson is in it. So, you know, I figured, all right, we're gonna throw this out there, and you know, the man makes an appearance, and I love seeing him in everything, so we're gonna get him out there. So, those are my options.
The hand that rocks the cradle and not Congo, huh?
Nah, I like this one. I mean, I like Hand That Rocks the Cradle better.
Okay.
Congo was good. It wasn't great for me.
It's okay. I was just thinking his part was a little bit more prominent, but that's all right. It's not screen time that matters. It's the impact that they make.
Yes.
Well, I was looking at all of the actors in all these films, and obviously there are some that are fantastic that you could pick out. The Bill Murray films are wonderful. Sigourney Weaver, you could just go on and on and on. There's so many great choices here. I picked a character that I think people will appreciate because he does make a return here, Walter Peck. I'm talking about William Atherton. And so I've got three films, one of which everybody knows, and that's Die Hard, of course.
Yes.
That's probably his quintessential asshole, but before he played the asshole in that film, he was an asshole in Real Genius as well.
Yes, he was.
And we had Real.
I was going to be mad at you if you didn't mention
no,
Real
no.
Genius.
Absolutely.
We had Real Genius as a movie of the month, I think, back in last summer sometime. And we talked about the film then. And I don't know where the turn in his career took. You know, it must have been Real Genius because he was so good in that. And then the next thing we know, he's in Die Hard and Die Hard 2 doing the same kind of character. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like he was typecast in that sort of role. Before that, he'd been in some very sympathetic roles. It's been a long time since I saw Sugarland Express, so I can't really say how good he was in that movie. That's not the movie I'm going to pick. My third film that I'm going to talk about is one that I did see this last year because I did it on my Thursday's Look Back project, and that's The Day of the Locust from 1975, which is a film that I don't care for, but it's really interesting, and he is the star of the film, basically, and he's very good in the movie, and he's got an interesting story arc. He has some moments where he's very sympathetic. There are some moments when he's reprehensible, and the finish of the film is, really disturbing. So
it's a creepy movie.
We did
it on the Forgotten Film Cast a few years ago with, I think, Tony Kogan was on with me, and it is a bizarre film.
I had never seen it. For years, I'd kind of pushed it away, even though it's from 1975, one of my favorite movie years. I just skipped it over and over again. I had the poster, but I never saw the movie. And then, like I said, when I was doing my project last year, I said, well, I'm going to commit to this. And I watched it, and I said, yeah, there's a reason I never saw this, because it is a weird, not particularly pleasant movie. But it's really interesting, and you know, it's about Hollywood in the old days, so how can you lose on that? Well, you watch it and you'll find out. But Atherton's great in those, and it was nice to get him back in this film that we talked about today, although I think they could have gotten more out of the character there. Well, let's finish up by thanking everybody, of course, and giving them a chance to plug whatever they've got that they want people to turn their eyes and ears to. So, Lisa, let's start with you. What have you got this week that people should be looking at or listening to?
Well, I'd love if you would listen to anything on the Rabbit Hole Podcast Network. You can catch me there on a show called Pictures and Conversations, a Rabbit Hole Podcast book club. We release new episodes on the 20th of every month, and our next book is going to be a book called Delicious Monsters, which is a dual time frame kind of a haunted novel with two girls who are in the same haunted house 10 years apart. And then you can also catch me on Between the Scares, a podcast where Jason Soto and I are slowly working our way through everything that Jason Blum and Blumhouse Productions have put out into the world. And if you're going to put your eyes on anything, please, 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 please go to the theater and see Late Night with the Devil. This is a horror film that's getting a lot of buzz, but for whatever reason, a very limited release. I honestly, before 2 days ago, thought that I was going to have to wait for streaming because I didn't think theaters around here were going to show it. Lo and behold, they are, but it's only two screenings a day. And theaters seem to forget that horror fans are going to show up. We don't care what the movie is. And if it's a good one, we're definitely going to show up. It's a fantastic film. You need to see it in the theater. Please, please, please show these theaters that we want the small films. Let's get Cord Jefferson's words out there. Take those billion-dollar budgets, break them up into five smaller films. This is such a cool film about a 70s night show, a late-night TV show, and how one man who's been grieving for his wife makes a decision to ensure that his Halloween episode is really going to put him on the map, and this definitely does. If you've ever seen The Cleansing Hour, which is a film on Shudder, it's about like a live streaming TV show that goes wrong, it would be a fantastic double feature. So please go see Late Night with the Devil in the theater and then watch it again at home. And check out The Cleansing Hour on Shudder or any other streaming service. You can rent it there too.
I had no idea that it was actually playing in theaters. I was just about to pull the trigger on watching it on streaming. Now I'm going to look for it in the theater because, as
Yay!
You know, that's always the preference here.
Definitely. And it was a full theater when I was there last night, so I'm happy to report that.
Excellent. Matt, how about you? What do you want us to look at or hear or see?
I'm definitely going to echo, go watch Late Night with the Devil. David Dalmachian is so damn good. So good in his first lead role, I think. Such a good actor anyway. Go support horror all throughout theatres. For me, you can head over to whatiwatchtonight.co.uk and read what I've been watching. You can follow me on all of the socials as well, What I Watch Tonight. You can listen to me on the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast each week with my buddy John Book, where we'll be talking about Frozen Empire as well, and it's usually the major releases that week. And over on Star Wars Sessions, our weekly Star Wars show, which we call probably Britain's Greatest Star Wars Podcast. So that's me, yeah, and go watch films in cinema.
Excellent. Todd, what do you want us to see or hear?
Well, of course, we've got episodes of the Forgotten Film Cast that have been hitting lately. Some of the most recent ones, we did an episode on a 1997 direct-to-video film called Drive, which stars Mark Dacascos and Kadeem Hardison and Brittany Murphy before she was a big star. And it's it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that movie quite a bit. Also did an episode on a 1991 Sharon Stone film she made just before she became a big star. So just before Basic Instinct, she was in a movie called Scissors. Not as good of a movie, but a good discussion. So that episode is out now, and I'm working on an episode that'll be hitting here the next day or two. I think Richard will appreciate this. Toby Rohn joined me because he just wrote a book about this movie. So we talked about, from 1977, Clint Eastwood's The Gauntlet. So
Ooh,
that is coming
nice.
Up.
Nice. Excellent. I'm looking forward to seeing and listening to those things for sure. I was mentioning earlier that there was going to be more trailer talk. Lisa, every time I start thinking about this project that I've started, I'm reminded of you because it started all because of the trailers. I bought some Blu-rays a couple of weeks ago that are just trailers. I sat and watched 6 hours of trailers one day.
Oh, wow.
And then the next day, I put in the other Blu-ray and watched 4 more hours, and I've still got 2 more hours to go on that one. And I've got 2 more of them to watch.
Oh, that's cool.
This new project that I've started, I've titled it Grindhouse Alley, and it's basically looking back at those films from the 70s and 80s and the late 60s that are clearly exploitation films. That they don't necessarily have any redeeming value other than that they are full of sex, violence, and assorted other unpleasant and undignified things that are designed to draw people's attention. And
this sounds like a great way to spend your time, Richard.
Well, it's, you know, foolish of me because, you know, it's a rabbit hole that I'm going down and I'm having too much fun. This week's episode is on Death Wish 2.
Ah, very nice.
Which is the start of Charles Bronson's descent into merely exploitation material. Before that, I think he was a legitimate actor. He had good parts in a lot of movies. He made some serious films, made some crap. But boy, once Death Wish 2 came out, that's all he made afterwards was crap.
And you gotta go where the money is.
Yeah, and I think that's what he did. I'm afraid I enjoyed the movie, although it is despicable. There are things about it that you just go, I didn't need that in my life. But Charles Bronson taking care of the bad guys, that's another one of those things that I can do just about any day of the week. So that's what's new on my podcast and on my website. So I hope everybody gets a chance to check into those things. I want to thank my guests again for joining us this week. Thank you, Lisa, Matt, and Todd, for sharing a little bit of time with us and talking about Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. I got to tell you, you know, it's just one of those things. When we get to the end of the show, I feel like I should just say, I'll see you in the fabric of the universe. Thanks, everybody.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on X, formerly Twitter, at Lambcast. And you can find us on YouTube as well. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com. We'd also love it if you would leave a review on iTunes. Ha 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 ha